conversations with people in pursuit of truth that he sees as being beneficial to them. So once he's had his dialogue with someone, he doesn't need to write it down because he's achieved his purpose in that dialogue, which is educating that individual or being educated himself by that individual. So the purpose of dialogue being that fundamental personal change for Socrates is very different than what philosophy became. Once philosophy started being written down, you started having certain schools of thought, literally schools. You'd have schools that would teach certain ways of thinking based off of people's writings, and then other people write down other things and teach their schools of thought, and then you'd have these debates and discussions and conflicts between these schools, who often became much more rigid in their thinking because they were staying with ideas that may not be appropriate to new contexts and new situations. I do want to stop for a little bit with your comments on Aristotle, because I think that's very true, that Aristotle derives his ideas from the idea of Socratic dialogue, the idea of non-contradiction, that if you contradict yourself, Socrates will call you on it, the law of the excluded middle, that, you know, something has to be one way or the other, there's no middle ground. The third one, the essentially the law of identity, that if A is A, if I say this, it should be the same as if anyone else says that. At least the truth value of what I'm saying should be constant, no matter who says it. That's a surprisingly insightful idea, and it's also a very democratic idea, so to speak. Then again, it might not be, because if someone says something and the majority disagrees, it's one of those questions. I'm reminded of our last show where we talked a little bit about the tyranny of the majority. It's one of those things where you have to think very carefully of, if anyone said these words, would they be true, or would they be true if anyone said them? That is, which is the principle of identity, and then the follow-up principles of non-contradiction of, well, then you have to say things that anyone could say, they can't be contradictory, and then they have to be consistent with each other and consistent with reality itself in some way, that you have to be talking about things that don't have a middle that can be excluded. Like if you're talking about color, you can't say that, you know, all things are red or blue and there's nothing in between, there's nothing different, because there obviously are things that are different. So I guess that is an interesting place to stop back and think on, I guess, as a reflection on what philosophy should be, is we've talked about where dialogue comes from and what its purpose should be. I think we've kind of come to the most abstract, basic conclusion we can, and that is that philosophy is, in essence, an abstraction of what conversation should be between people. It's an approximation of saying, this is what conversation between people should look like. But I think that is probably going too far.
What do you think is going too far? Like, is it because it's this abstraction and therefore it's like kind of bad? And it also kind of implies like, well, we should go back to that original experience. We should just go back to, because the interesting thing about Socrates is I don't know if he was necessarily aiming at some kind of, well, he might, I mean, the consequence of it was, of course, that like, oh, wow, we find that when we talk, we kind of want to agree with each other. So there must be something, there must actually be something that we all agree on. And then maybe that's like some reified, that's like the reified result is objectivity. But really what I find with Socrates is really, he's just really curious about what people say. He asks, is like, how is it with you? And then you state your opinion, and then he'll say, okay, well, that's really interesting, but your neighbor said this, or I think this, or, you know, you said this one thing earlier, though, that sounds like it doesn't square with this. So, like, what's going on with that? I mean, you can think that to its logical conclusion and say, well, Socrates was interested in objectivity. I think that he probably was, but I don't think he would have thought of it in that way. I would have thought that his experience of this was just, I'm just going to go out. People have these opinions. There may be some truth to it, but the whole point is they must have opinions for some reason, right? This is the thing. This is one of the things that philosophy has kind of taught me is even if people are wrong, they're either wrong for a reason or they're trying to be right. People don't just believe the things they believe for no reason. You can kind of get to the bottom of that if you just talk to them. I think that's one of the things that, among the other things of like producing the conditions for objectivity or a kind of a democratic ideal.
Earlier, when I was saying that essentially it seems a problem is because if philosophy is nothing more than ordinary common sense conversation in pursuit of truth, then what is all of the academic history of philosophy that we have? Is it just a collection of people's common sense intuitions of what they thought was true based off of their time and place and experience? And if that's the case, isn't it just anecdotal evidence? And if it is anecdotal evidence, then isn't it considered to be somewhat more unreliable in the scientific sense?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I think that a lot of people would, why would you go and read all of these things that these people thought hundreds or thousands of years ago when you could instead rely on, you know, your own observations or scientific observations made through rigorous experimentation that you could have done with your own senses.
Yeah. And that does remind me of what I was thinking, this idea that you can get to, it seems like one of the things that Socrates and by extension philosophy is interested in is, well, even if your ideas are wrong, they must be that for some reason, and you can kind of get to the bottom of them. I think that's an extension of what you're asking, though, is, well, say, I don't know, let's take Descartes. He's kind of a famous example. Descartes arrives at particular ideas. Are those ideas just conditioned by, I mean, he was quite sick his whole life. And if you read the Meditations, there's a kind of way of reading it as like, well, maybe he was having some kind of episode. So if he's basing it on this, doesn't that, if it's just kind of based on his position that Socrates is investigating, doesn't that make it anecdotal? That's kind of what I'm hearing you saying. Is that right?
I guess the question becomes, fundamentally speaking, when we're trying to build our ideas of what truth should be, and we're trying to base ideas about how do we arrive at the truth, modern society wants to reject individual arguments for specific ideas that are untested. If you want to have an idea about something and say that this is true, the modern context says, like, well, you know, where's the data? Where's the statistics? Where's the history of people who've tried similar things like that?
Yeah.
Or there's the other side of things. Like, in philosophy today, now we have, you know, in epistemology, there's the correspondence theory of truth. There's the coherence theory of truth. And there's the pragmatic theory of truth. That whatever is, you know, useful is, mm-hmm. is true. And I mean, to some degree, you know, those theories of truth have always existed. There's always been people whose approach to truth has been what's pragmatic, what yeah. coheres, or what corresponds. To summarize those very simply, it's literally what is useful to me, what fits with what I already know, or what corresponds to what I observe or know to be true from my perspective or from other people's perspective. So the correspondence theory of truth tries to take an objective lens, whereas the other two don't necessarily take that objective lens.
Yeah, so the correspondence theory of truth would say, I'm holding a glass of water, and since it is the case that I am holding a glass of water, my statement is true.
Yeah, so there are things like that where, in the modern day, the question of how far we can trust our observations, especially about complicated matters like the nature of ideas, the nature of our own minds. We have so much to draw from in terms of psychology and neuroscience and all of these other fields that the idea of will we ever know exactly what's going on in the physical sense, some people would say once we understand the workings of the human brain in the physical sense, then we understand the human mind, we're done. We don't need philosophy anymore. We don't need the ideas of the past to deal with things because now we know things better in a more empirical sense. I think there's something lacking from that, but I think that would be a modern perspective.
What do you think is lacking from it?
I think that the pursuit of truth is what drives fundamentally those scientific fields. And so if you are unwilling to look at your philosophical assumptions and say, well, what do I think the nature of truth to be? What am I pursuing? And is that different from how other people have pursued it? And if it is different enough, does that mean that I will not necessarily be able to communicate with these people? Or if I communicate with these people, they will draw different interpretations from what my experience suggests to be true. Now, and how do you cope with that? How do you speak with people?
So it's like so it's a fear of like incommunicability brought up by objective truth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, they experience things which they feel to be true or know to be true, which they can't necessarily communicate. And I think this is what is so interesting about philosophy, is through a lot of these thought experiments, what you're able to convey are little mental pictures for human experience of making certain types of decisions and what emotions or ideas are in play with those decisions. Like with the example that you mentioned kind of near in the beginning of the show of lending a sword to someone who's potentially gone mad. There are some emotions there, which even though we exist in a totally different culture and time period, as human beings, we can latch on to that situation and feel like, I can imagine myself in that situation and the type of things that I would feel in that situation. Is that the purpose of philosophy then? To essentially use our ability to imagine things creatively to increase our potential for better decision making?
Yeah. Like philosophy is kind of a little training ground for throwing us into situations that science couldn't possibly prepare us for. Like, how could science know what to do in that situation? I mean, that was the aspiration of utilitarianism, wasn't it? It was the reducing it down to sort of hedonic calculus, and then all you have to do is run the numbers. But we think that there's something kind of ethically impoverished about that. We think that actually the consideration of the particulars actually matters in this case. And I hear you suggesting that, well, maybe philosophy is a kind of preparation for looking at the particulars and really weighing things and taking the particular situation seriously, rather than feeling like you need to resort to some kind of metric or calculus. Am I hearing you right?
Yes. And I think that the other lesson that we learned from Socrates is it's very dangerous to be trapped in your own ideas.
Hmm.
The whole story behind the line of I know nothing, and because of that, I know something.
Right.
And that something is that I know nothing, is that Socrates goes on this little journey after being told that he's the wisest person to have ever lived, looking to find a wiser person.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes and talks to many people. But all of these people, some of whom are wiser than him in specific areas, claim to know things that they have no reason or justification, Socrates believes, for knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he kind of tears them down. It's interesting.
And so essentially the role of, well, his philosophical experiment was knowledge requires justification. And if you say you know something, even if you are very good at knowing other things, justifiably so, if you say you know something and that one thing is not properly justified, then you do not know that thing. In which case, it makes every belief or perspective that a person has potentially falsifiable, no matter how reliable or knowledgeable they might be in other ways. In other words, you can essentially be skeptical of the truth of any statement, regardless of where it comes from or who is speaking, assuming that is that you feel that they have a good reason or they haven't already given you a valid justification.
Yeah, I mean, because anyone could really say anything, but you can always say in response, well, how do you know that? Even if they give you the reason, you could say, well, what is the relation between those two? How do you know that that does what you think it does for what you say you believe? Why does it justify it? You can always kind of probe into these questions. That's really how Socrates got his...
And on one side of things... Or, well, we could say rather on the other side of things. I know that there's a school of Stoic philosophy, which I'm not incredibly familiar with, but essentially it dismisses dialogue as a means of making things better. And instead, it's what it suggests is that you should just essentially accept things as they are. And rather than dialoguing with people and attempting to change their mind or pursue truth by being other people, you should pursue truth by looking towards your own actions and controlling your own perceptions on things. And I guess that's kind of another point, which is that philosophy from the Socratic perspective is kind of socially centered. It's centered on benefiting other people through social interaction and through conversation. Whereas the more stoic mindset is centered on the individual rather than on society. And so there's that other question when it comes to philosophies of dialogue is, who are these dialogues for? Are you dialoguing for other people? Are you dialoguing for yourself? If you are dialoguing for other people, is that really what you should be doing? Is there a better use for your time than talking about philosophical concepts? A lot of people would argue that it's not worth talking about doing good things. Instead, it's only worth it if people actually go and do good things. And so talking about things is fundamentally meaningless if you never go and do things. I think a lot of people have that conception of philosophy, that it's just about talking about things and not about actually doing things.
Yeah, we're just spinning our wheels.
But I think that's really quite problematic, because everyone who does things has a pattern of behavior for how they do things that they need to analyze and think about if they want to communicate with other people and if they want to improve their own way of doing things.
Yeah, so kind of to go back to your question, because I think it's an interesting question of, well, when we're dialoguing, who are we dialoguing? Are we dialoguing for ourselves, or are we dialoguing for the other? Well, there is the fact, and this is a fact, that you can't have a dialogue with only one person. You can think, in which you actualize your self-consciousness and you have a sort of dialogue with yourself, but it's not really a dialogue. I mean, for some reason, talking to someone else actually kind of, like, think about like two asteroids kind of like colliding into one another. There's pieces actually fall off when two asteroids kind of crash, or when two bodies clash, there's actual force there. Whereas if someone were to just think, I mean, you can logically deduce truth and false, like truth and falsity in your own thinking. But for some, and this is something that I have like thought about, and I can't entirely wrap my head around why it does this, but genuine dialogue strips more from you than just the bare bones logical structure of like what is false. You actually have someone with a, you know, another set of intuitions who will call you out on things that just don't make sense. Even if they are logically consistent, they just don't make sense. Like, why was I even thinking about this? Or why was, I don't know. It's just, there's a lot more falls off the bone when you're actually speaking with someone else. So, but to go back to your question, is it for someone else or is it for me? I think if we want to think about this, we should bring up Buber again a little bit and think, realize that a dialogue has two people. It has the I and the it or the thou, but that dialogue is a kind, it's almost its own whole that serves its own purpose, has its own reason for being. When two people are dialoguing, I get this real sense that there isn't sort of an instrumentality to it. I'm not thinking like, well, I'm getting so much from this. I mean, you know, I'm talking to my philosophy professor and I'm getting all this advice, you know, career advice or something, but that's not really dialogue. When I talk with professors about philosophy, I feel like they're getting just as much out of it as I am. And so in a way, it's almost a null question of, well, who's, you know, what's in it for me? Or, you know, I'm doing this for someone else. We both are doing it together. We both get something out of it. I think we misunderstand the question if we ask, well, who's getting what out of it? I think it's more or less that, sure, like, you'd be hard-pressed to say that you don't get something out of a genuine dialogue. So I'm not trying to say, like, don't, you know, you don't actually get anything out of it. But it's not in this dichotomous sense of, like, okay, well, you know, like, when young kids are, like, trying to split chocolate milk or something and they're trying to really even it out. It's not like that. You can't do that with a dialogue. You both only get something out of it if you both get something equally out of it, I feel.
Yeah, I do think that dialogue challenges you to find words apart from your own individualized experience. So your words are not for you anymore. They're for another person. And you can create words for many purposes, spin them off in many different directions. But fundamentally speaking, whatever words you say are going to impact that relationship with that other person and your relationship with who you think you are as a person and how, because of their response. Dialogue itself is a process of social and self-discovery.
Yeah, so you raise this question of, well, what are the sort of conditions of dialogue? And we can actually look at one of Plato's dialogues to find one of those conditions. And I think it's actually interesting because there's lots of moments where like genuine Socratic experiences come out through Plato's readings. I mean, sometimes we get Plato putting a lot of ideas in Socrates' mouth. That's clearly Plato when he's got these theories of ideas or theory of forms. Socrates said he never taught, and he not only did he know nothing, he taught nothing, not even like a methodology or anything like that. But it's interesting because sometimes you do have, I'm saying all this as a kind of a preamble to, if you read the Gorgias, which is Plato's dialogue between, primarily, I'm thinking specifically between Socrates and Callicles. One of my professors said Callicles is one of the most feared people by philosophers. I mean, he literally says, you know, Socrates, you ought to be dragged into the street and beaten. You know, you are like a, when I see a child doing philosophy, I think it's a beautiful thing, but they grow out of it. You're an old man, you know, you're doing this childish thing. It's embarrassing. I should just beat you. But it's interesting because by the end of the dialogue, Callicles stops speaking and kind of, you know, the Socratic method has been worked on Callicles and Socrates has to monologue. Well, he's kind of doing like a dialogical thing where he's positing back and forth. Like, what would Callicles say? So he's a good interlocutor. He's a sympathetic listener of Callicles. He's kind of internalized what his responses would be. But Callicles is an enemy of Socrates. He physically threatens him. He's not a friend at all. And by the end of it, dialogue stops. So in response to one of your, or to your question, well, what are one of the conditions for it? Is it truth? Is it kind of etiquette? I think it goes farther than that. I think it's friendship. The people need to be able to come together and have a conversation. If they're going to threaten to beat each other, those are not grounds conducive of dialogue. So one of the experiences, or one of the things that the Socratic experience tells us, is that we should remain the friend of the person we're talking to, whether a certain kind of formal structure of etiquette opens up around that. Again, I think it does kind of get calcified by the principle of non-contradiction. Imagine contradicting your friend. You're not really listening to me if you just contradict everything I say. You actually listen to what they have to say and then you consider it. That's what Socrates does when he has to monologue. He says, well, Callicles would probably say this to what I have to say. He's a friend to Callicles, even if it's not a good idea to be friends with Callicles. But all of this is to say that what is one of the conditions of dialogue? Well, some kind of friendship or amiable feeling towards one another, a willingness to engage with or listen to one another. You know, maybe the other person is speaking falsehoods. We're still willing to listen and kind of pick it apart. So it's not strictly truth. Maybe people might be rude, like Callicles. So maybe it's not strictly etiquette, but it is a willingness to listen that kind of has its spirit in a spirit of friendship, which I think Socrates embodied.
Yeah, so a spirit of willing to be able to befriend other people and to kind of take on that empathetic or sympathetic listening.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that you kind of have the natural ending point for a dialogue where whatever matter that you wanted to discuss is resolved. You've either gotten to truth or you've gotten to a point where you've figured out the matter is trivial. An answer is not necessary. You kind of get to that point of either there is no answer necessary and this isn't as big as we thought, or we've uncovered the truth of the situation, or and this is kind of the friendship element, the relationship can no longer stand dialogue.
Right.
You've strained it out of a person's experience. Everything that one person has said or wants to say has been said, and at that point the dialogue just has to end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the usual result of a Socratic dialogue is that we have just utterly failed to arrive at an answer. I mean, we've tried our best. There must be an answer. We're taking this seriously, but we don't have it right now. It's out there. I don't know at any real point whether it's entirely conclusive that Socrates or Plato have arrived at a truth. I mean, they certainly are using things like dialogue and a kind of structure of logic to navigate the journey towards an answer to these things. But an apperception of that seems very rare. Like, very rarely do people say, we have it. We know what knowledge is. That doesn't actually happen in, like, in the Theaetetus, which is about, which is just the dialogue, with, that is the question, what is knowledge? They don't, they go through several proposed definitions, but at some point they just say no, like, none of these really stand. I think that Socrates would say that we're better off for that. We've kind of, again, we've kind of, like, shed these wrong answers, but I don't think he would say that it's all pointless, so we should give it up. I mean, if he might say, like, there's that, I think it's in the Parmenides, where Parmenides is interrogating young Socrates. He says, what's the form of a stick? What's the form of mud? He's like, they don't really have forms. They're just sticks and mud. So maybe there are some trivial matters in the Platonic universe. But it seems like everything that Socrates pursues is worth pursuing, even if we don't have the answer yet.
And I guess that's, well, to put it in computer science terms, the best type of philosophical inquiries are the ones that are able to reach truth in the most efficient and effective way possible. When you think about it that way, all of a sudden, deductive logic makes so much more sense, because this thing is literally designed to arrive at truth with the minimal use of words.
Yeah, you just run down the, you just derive it. You know, you run down the logic gates.
But at the same time, it is almost humanly incomprehensible. Most of the time, if you look at a purely deductive argument that's rather extensive, even one that's on half a page to a page, it's not the type of thing that's easy to read. It's the type of thing that becomes very highly complex, and you have to, and very dense, and does a lot of work very quickly, but often can very easily create inaccuracies, or can, in one leap of logic, leap over another leap of logic and create inconsistencies very quickly. I'm not going to dive into the philosophy of symbolic logic, because that's a nut topic for another episode, but I think that those are some also worthy considerations on what a philosophy of dialogue should be. Well, I think we're out of time for today. It's been, I think, an interesting show questioning about the philosophical nature of dialogue, which has gone back to really the very basic idea of what philosophy should be in terms of, should it be a conversation? Should it be a Socratic dialogue? Does that require logical rules? Or does it require something more than logical rules? Does it require a fundamental understanding of social etiquette and a commitment to truth or a commitment to values and exploring virtues and what should be good luck, the qualities that are? All right, you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang. Goodbye for now.
The Canadian Philosophy Show is now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Go ahead and check out our archives. Just search for The Canadian Philosophy Show and we should show up.
The Polygon Gallery is pleased to present Deckchair Cinema, an outdoor summer film series taking place on Kate's Deck, located on the waterfront directly in front of the gallery. Hosted for 10 Thursdays beginning June 29th, the screenings commence at sunset and will be complemented by music and entertainment leading up to curtain time. Admission to Deckchair Cinema is by donation and includes access to the gallery's summer exhibition, Jeremy Shaw, Phase Shifting Index. To learn more about this event, visit thepolygon.ca.